Swarm with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Amanda. Welcome to the 65th episode of Robots. In today's episode, we speak with Alan Winfield from the Bristol Robotics Laboratory in the UK. As a pioneer in swarm robotics, he'll be telling us about the challenges in deploying large numbers of robots in real-world applications. As a fellow blogger, he'll be touching on the topic of robotics and the media and the idea of making roboticists more ethical. But first, as always, let's listen to the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thanks, Amanda. Researchers at the Austrian Society for Innovative Computer Sciences and Oregon State University are developing an autonomous sailboat to act as a maritime research platform. The robotic sailboat is based on the Autonomous Sailing Vehicle, or ASV, rowboat, which won this year's World Robotics Sailing Championship in Canada. The fully automated boat will be equipped with sensors for passive acoustic monitoring of marine mammals, without disturbances by noise created by the motors and propellers of motorized boats. A potential further application of the rowboat technology are intelligent moving sensor buoys for reconnaissance and surveillance. In other news, researchers at the Healthcare Robotics Lab at the Georgia Institute of Technology have built a health service robot to sponge bath patients. The robot uses cameras and lasers to evaluate the patient's skin. It then uses two flexible robot arms with low levels of stiffness to wipe the patient's body using wet towels. Relating his experience, the robot's first patient said, "In the beginning, I felt a bit tense, but never scared. As the experiment progressed, my trust in the robot grew and my tension waned. Throughout the experiment, I suffered little to no discomfort." For videos of the robotic sailboat and sponge-wielding robot arm, have a look at the robots forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Thanks, Christine. Alan Winfield was at the EPFL a couple weeks ago for the International Symposium on Distributed Autonomous Robotic Systems. After one of his amazing talks, we had the chance to get him on the show for a more in-depth coverage of the field of swarm robotics, its potential, and pitfalls. He'll be telling us about his role as Senior Media Fellow for the UK Research Funding Agency that has gotten him blogging and tweeting, as well as his involvement in the ongoing discussion about roboethics. Hi, Alan. Welcome to Robots.
Hello, Sabine. I'm delighted to be here.
Can you please tell us a bit more about yourself?
Sure. Well, I guess you need the sort of formal thing, which is that I'm a professor of electronic engineering at the University of the West of England in Bristol, and also one of the co-founders of what is now the Bristol Robotics Laboratory.
You're a reference in swarm robotics. Can you tell us what this field is?
Well, that's very kind of you to say, Sabine. Swarm robotics is to me hugely interesting because it's a field of robotics that touches biology very closely, and it also, I think, presents some very special challenges. So I would define swarm robotics as the study of multi-robot systems where each robot really only has very local sensing, local communications, and control is completely distributed across the swarm. So in other words, there's no kind of hierarchical or centralized command and control system. And I think that the thing that's most One of the things that's most interesting to me about swarms is the idea that the overall behavior of the swarm is somehow self-organized and is an emergent property of all of the kind of microscopic interactions between the individual robots.
Can you give us an example from nature of what the inspiration is?
Sure, yes. I mean, there are many examples in nature of these self-organizing systems, but certainly the most dramatic are social insects. So, both ants and termites. I think termites are especially interesting because of the astonishing, remarkable phenomenon of the termite's mound, this huge structure which is built by these tiny, tiny animals. And of course, a big question for biologists is how do they do that? And I think, you know, in biology we're beginning to understand how a very large number of they're still quite complicated animals, but relative to humans, rather simple animals, how a very large number of animals can do that. And what we know for sure is that there is no kind of brain termite that is directing the individuals directing the actions of the individual termites in a foreman or some kind of controller saying, you know, will termite number 783,257 please go to the west wing to repair a hole in the wall? We know that doesn't happen. And the mechanisms by which we believe these social insects can achieve quite an amazing self-organization, both nest building, kind of farming, collecting food, collecting prey, deciding on a new nest site, moving the colony, all of these things, quite remarkable phenomena. And we think we understand enough about the mechanisms of how they work to be able to copy some of those mechanisms in robots. So that's why, in a sense, there's a very strong link, a close link between biology and robotics in the fields of swarm robotics.
I know you've been making this link with robotics. Can you give us an example of one of your systems?
Yes, I certainly can. Although I have to say, and it's important to say this, that right now there are no real-world examples of swarm systems. So all of the swarm systems that have been built so far are in labs, and only in labs. So an example that we have in my lab in Bristol is a swarm of robots that does foraging. Now, foraging is particularly interesting in ants, because we know that ants, not all ants, but some ants, do division of labour. So in other words, there's a kind of, think of the ants as having a kind of labour pool. And depending on the amount of food in the environment, the ants will somehow regulate or adapt the number of, or the ratio of ants that go out foraging to the ratio of ants that stay home in the nest. And again, it's an interesting question in biology and in robotics as to figure out how to build or how to make the rules or how to design the rules to give rise to that automatic adaptation of division of labour. So we've used EPUC robots. In fact, EPUCs were designed and built right here in EPFL originally. And so we have a number of EPUC robots that effectively run around in our arena and do foraging. Of course, they're not really foraging for food, so we have kind of virtual food or virtual energy, but it's nevertheless true that the rather like ants, our robots are foraging for their own energy. and we can observe this very interesting behavior of adaptation. In other words, the swarm varying the ratio of foragers to resters. And it's very interesting that if we change the amount of food in the environment, kind of virtual food, then we very quickly see the swarm completely automatically adapt the ratio of foragers to resters in response to the change, if you like, in the amount of food in the environment.
You said something really interesting before, and that's that all the swarm systems are in labs currently. Mm. What do you think is needed to get them into the real world?
Wow, yes, that's a good question. The problem fundamentally is, well, actually there isn't just one problem, there are several problems, but I think the fundamental problem is that we don't know how yet to prove the correctness of swarm systems, swarm algorithms. So the problem is, well, of course, as you might expect, all real world systems, particularly if they have any element of safety critical or mission critical thing, all systems like that have to be proven. You have to be proven to be safe, to be correct, and so on, dependable. I'm very interested in the idea of dependable swarms, but one of the problems with swarm robotics, it's a characteristic of swarm robotics, that you design the behaviors of the individual robots. You don't design the behavior of the overall system. So you hope, in fact, you design in a way that the behavior that you want from the overall system emerges from the self-organized interactions of all of the individuals. Now, the problem is that if you were to go along to a certification body and say, look, we've built a swarm, it's a swarm that will do, for the sake of argument, will do harvesting in a field. So, you know, we have a crop and we have maybe 100 robots, and you put the 100 robots in the field, and together they will self-organize to harvest the crop. Now, that isn't a safety critical application, but it's still pretty important that they do the right thing. So clearly those robots will, you'd have to be able to say something about the robots collecting all of the crop and not just kind of 80% of it, and collecting all of the crop within a reasonable and acceptable period of time. Now, right now, it's very difficult to prove things about swarm behaviours in a way that would satisfy, if you like, commercial or especially safety critical systems. Now, I say it's difficult; it's not impossible, and there are researchers in the swarm robotics community that are worrying about these questions of the provability, if you like, of the correctness and the reliability, the performance, and so on of swarm systems. I said there were a number of reasons. That's the most important reason. I mean, there are other, in a sense, almost more obvious reasons. And if you take the example I've just given, even making one robot that would be able to move around in a field and collect, you know, pick fruits or harvest potatoes or something, even that's a difficult engineering problem. So to develop swarm systems for the real world combines, in a way, both hard engineering problems for single robots with also difficult problems of proof of correctness and dependability and reliability for swarm systems.
So I was wondering if you have any concrete proposals in how we can actually do this.
Yes, I do. In fact, I have several kind of threads of work or directions of work that I think, in a way, I think all of them would be necessary to build dependable swarms, to engineer swarms. Let's call it swarm engineering. One of them is to be able to prove the correctness of the swarm, as I already mentioned, and I think that requires, for instance, mathematical modelling, and in fact, I've worked with a colleague here in EPFL, Alcherio Martinoli, in the field of probabilistic mathematical modelling of swarms. In fact, it's a thing that Alcherio is particularly famous for. But I think that mathematical modelling is just one aspect. Another aspect is looking at the modelling of reliability and looking at fault tolerance, for instance. Perhaps I can, if I can elaborate a little bit more. There is a bit of a kind of myth, if you like, in swarm robotics that swarm robot systems are somehow intrinsically highly robust and scalable. And it's surprising how many papers in swarm robotics start by saying something like, it is well known that swarms are highly scalable and robust. And there's a kind of assumption that if you can make something work with 10 robots, then it'll work just as well with 10,000 robots. Unfortunately, that's not true. One of the things that I've been interested in over the last 3 or 4 years is modelling the reliability of swarm systems, and particularly thinking about fault tolerance. So you might think that because you've got lots of robots, and especially if they're all the same, so it's a homogeneous swarm, then if some of the robots fail, it's okay because you've got others kind of standing by. And that is certainly true. And it's true to say that swarm systems do have a high degree of fault tolerance, but not as high perhaps as we'd like to imagine. And one of the problems with swarm systems is that if robots fail not completely, but partially, then they can actually disrupt the overall kind of desired behavior of the swarm. So, I mean, if I can go back to ants, we've probably all seen nature movies of leaf cutter ants. So you see a whole bunch of ants kind of all going the same direction, carrying a piece of leaf. And occasionally you see an ant going in the opposite direction, carrying a piece of leaf. Well, that's probably okay, but it's interesting that if an ant goes crazy, then actually other ants will actually notice that and do something about it. And it's the point is that in swarm robotic systems, if you have partial failures, not complete failures are okay because they just a dead robot becomes a thing in the environment that the other robots have to avoid. But if robots fail in a partial way, in other words, part of the robot works but another part has failed, then it is possible, and we've, you know, I've done models of this where those partially failed robots actually somehow hinder or thwart, actively prevent, if you like, the overall swarm behaviour that you want to arise. So the problem is that if you start to build a model, a reliability model that takes account of partial failures, it's then that you realise that swarms aren't as scalable as we think. I mean, if you think about it, if there's a given constant probability of a robot failing in this bad way, in other words, it's a partial failure, computer scientists call these Byzantine failures, then obviously it stands to reason that if you have 10,000 robots, then you're far more likely to have some of those kinds of failures than if you have 10 robots. So that, I think, is... I'm going back to your swarm engineering question. That's one of the things that I'm also interested in trying to go in the direction of dependable swarms. But in fact, in building dependable systems, and particularly in proving that they're safe and reliable and can be used in real world environments, there isn't one single thing you need to do. You need to have a kind of, if you like, a set of tools and methodologies for assuring the correctness and the safety and reliability and dependability of systems.
With respect to these bad failures which influence your swarm, what do you want to do? Should we make better robots? Should we make sure there's always a much larger proportion of working robots compared to non-working robots? Or what's your solution to this problem?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's certainly true that you can improve the overall dependability of the system by making the individual robots more reliable, and that's... You know, there's no getting away from that. In a way, we should not assume that you can have a whole bunch of unreliable robots, but it'll be okay. I think that's a bad assumption. But given that a robot swarm is kind of by definition bio-inspired, then it seems to me a good idea that we should also have a bio-inspired approach to these kind of partially failed robots. So what I think would be very interesting would be to build a kind of immune response into a swarm of robots, so that if, for instance, we have these kind of partial failures, that robots that fail in a bad way that somehow is upsetting the overall desired behavior of the swarm, then it would be perhaps interesting and possible to see if other robots could somehow detect that kind of crazy guy like a kind of granuloma formation. Some of the good robots might surround this crazy robot and kind of isolate it from the rest of the swarm. That would be kind of bio-inspired approach where those good robots are almost sacrificing themselves to isolate, to take out, if you like, or take out of harm's way badly failed, partially failed robot. Another approach might be that you have special robots, as it were, in the swarm that act as kind of immune system robots that look out for these behaviours, and it's an open question. But it's one that, in fact, I have started to very actively discuss with a colleague in the UK, University of York, John Timmis, who is his specialism is artificial immune systems.
That's really interesting. You gave a beautiful example on your blog. We'll talk about it a bit later. Saying that basically the cell that the body is probably a swarm system of cells, if you want, and they had to come up with an immune system eventually. So do you think it might actually be an enabler for large numbers of individuals?
Yeah, it's... I mean, I... kind of have to be rather cautious about making any claims to have insights, as it were, to biology from robotics. But it does seem to me that when you do the when you think about large swarms of robots, then in some rather abstract way, a robot can be thought of as a cell, and certainly, although swarm robots generally don't join together to form kind of multi-robot swarms, although actually there are some very interesting projects. One that I'm involved in is a project called Cimbrian that is looking at exactly that question of swarming robots self-organizing and joining to form kind of organisms, artificial organisms. But if we accept the analogy, it's perhaps even just a metaphor, I'm not sure it's an analogy, between robots and cells, then the idea that scaling up the number of robots from, as I say, a small number, 10 to 10,000, actually, in biological terms, that's still not a very large number, is, and given that a swarm system is, by definition, a complex self-organizing system. Now, multicellular animals, even simple multicellular animals, are complex self-organizing systems, self-organizing assemblages of cells. Now, it's very interesting, hugely interesting, I think, that evolution had to solve the problem, if you like, quote, invented immune systems very early in the emergence of multicellular life. It's an open question as to when exactly, but it could be something like 700 million years ago. And it seems to me that the reliability model of trying to scale up swarms of robots gives an insight or a hint towards an answer to the question, why do large-scale complex systems of individual things, be they robots or cells, need, and possibly even ants, I mean, there's another example, why do they need something that looks and behaves rather like an immune system?
So as I mentioned, you have a blog on robotics now where you talk about your ideas, your research. What's your interest in doing this?
Sure, I do. Yes, I find it really, really kind of fun to have a blog. And I started this, I think, around 4 years ago. And I just like the idea of being able to kind of write kind of mini essays, if you like. Just throw out ideas and not have the usual kind of thing in academic writing where you know everything has to be incredibly carefully constructed and then it goes to review and it's a very kind of complex process of getting published. And for me, the blog is a way of just disseminating ideas putting down thoughts that I like the immediacy of it. I mean, I remember when I first started the blog, I thought it was just great that I could write something and hit the publish button, and that's it. It's then kind of out in the world. That was at the time and still is a little bit scary, but I think it's great. And really, I think since I started my blog, I've thought about other benefits of it. I mean, I'm now very interested in open science. I believe I'm certainly an advocate in the practice of open science, and I think for people like us, you know, who are essentially publicly funded, I think it's right that we should be transparent about what we're doing and why we're doing it. And so I've now started to see my blog as also a part of a commitment to open science. So I like, and this is a relatively new thing, I'm now not just blogging about new ideas or, you know, kind of crazy thoughts, but also blogging about the process of doing robotics. So that it in a sense, trying to open up and be more transparent about that process. And so I also see the blog as a kind of wider dissemination. And I'm very committed not only to open science but to public engagement more generally. And my blog is a part of that.
So who do you want to reach it and why?
The blog, I mean, I'm happy for anybody who's interested, obviously, to read it. I don't think many people read it, but even if one or two read it and find it interesting and perhaps it causes them to think about robotics in a different way, then that's good for me. And I have to say, and I'm you've kind of reminded me that I wanted to say this, that I'm also keen to counter stories about robotics in the press and media. So the press tends to have a kind of rather lurid, kind of sensationalist view of robotics. So half the stories in the press are, you know, ooh, robots are going to take over the world, and are frankly rubbish. They tend to like to create a sense of alarm because, of course, it makes articles readable. And I think it's very important for those of us in the robotics community and in fact the wider science community to respond to that and not, as it were, just be silent. I think it's important, therefore, to counter those views. And again, my blog is a part of that.
The last question I wanted to discuss was roboethics a bit. So you were talking about robots taking over the world in the media, and actually there are some limits we should put to robotics. So before there were Asimov's laws, where basically we're giving the responsibility to the robots, and I know that maybe you have a different take on that. Can you tell us about it?
Sure, yes. I mean, I would say that generally, I think that scientists and roboticists should in fact, have some moral responsibility. I absolutely do not believe that scientists work in some kind of moral or ethical vacuum. And I think that robotics does raise new and interesting kind of ethical questions. I've argued and written that I think robots are a transformative technology, and almost raise unique ethical questions for this reason. I think that robots combine two things. Robotics combines two things. Robots, particularly the new generation of intelligent robots, have both agency, that is the ability to decide what to do next on their own, but also have the ability, often designed in a way to do this, to create an emotional response from human beings. So let me explain that a little bit more. We have plenty of things in the world already that have agency. So airline autopilots and room thermostats. A room thermostat, in a very simple way, has agency. It decides on its own whether to turn the boiler on or off. But you certainly don't develop an emotional relationship with your room thermostat, or at least I'm not sure that one would. We also have plenty of machines in the world that people become emotionally attached to, like, you know, iPods and Ferraris and so on. But generally, those systems don't have agency. So I think the thing that makes robots new and different from an ethical and societal dimension is that they combine both of these things. They combine agency with kind of an emotional response from the, you know, if you like, from the human interacting with or kind of using the robotic device.
So that's the ethical question, is how should we go about putting limits to this? I mean, should the robot not be nice to humans so that they don't want to be attached, they're not attached to them?
Well, yeah. I think that robots that are designed to interact with people should be nice. But nice not in a way that deceives. And one of the things that for instance we should be concerned about in human robot interaction, in robots that are designed to interact with humans, is robots that generate or even solicit an emotional response from a human being, and there's nothing wrong, I think, in principle with that, providing that the human, as it were, side of that human robot interaction is not deceived by that illusion. So I mean, it's easy, relatively easy now, to make robots that behave as if they have feelings. I mean, in our lab, we have a humanoid robot head. It's a high-fidelity kind of android robot head. You can look at this robot head, and it will look you in the eyes. And when you smile, it will smile back. Now, there's no intelligence in that robot head. It's just a bunch of motors and some fancy software to recognize your facial expression and just copy it. But there's a remarkable reaction. That when a robot behaves as if it has feelings. Now, for you and I think that's fine, because we can go along with that illusion. But imagine robots that are designed to work with perhaps children or vulnerable people, elderly people, people who perhaps are less able to kind of, you know, intellectualize the illusion of this robot that has feelings. So that I think is something we should be concerned about. And also there's another side of this, which is manufacturers of robots, of humanoid robots, that kind of exploit kind of emotional reaction and possibly even emotional dependency of humans on robots. I mean, it would be terrible if we found ourselves in a situation where people that had robots somehow neglected, normal life in order to kind of look after or in a sense, interact with their robot. So instead of, you know, phoning their grandmother, they feel that somehow they've got to give time to the robot, and I would worry about unethical commercial practices that would encourage that kind of dependency from humans to robots.
So we as roboticists, we have to be very careful in terms of what we put into our robots.
Exactly right. I mean, you mentioned Asimov's laws of robotics. Well, in my view, you can't, at least not in the foreseeable future, you can't make an ethical robot. And it kind of doesn't make sense to talk about robot ethics, because robots are not people, they're not persons. So you can't have an ethical robot, but you absolutely can, and I think should, have an ethical roboticist. So what I think is we need is not laws for robot ethics, but codes of conduct for ethical roboticists, if that makes sense.
Thanks, Alan, for being here with us on Robots.
I'm delighted. Thank you very much indeed.
That's it for today's episode of Robots. For more information on Alan Winfield, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Swarm with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.